From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Stem cells, global warming, genetic testing. These days, science looms over some of the loudest public policy debates. And let's face it, to talk intelligently about these issues, you need to know some science. But what if the very thought of statistics makes you want to scream? Fortunately, there's help. An unprecedented number of popular science books. In fact, British novelist David Lodge says good science writing has shoved literature to the side.
Popular science writing has had an extraordinary flowering in the last 10 or 20 years. It has come very much to replace the position in culture which literary criticism used to have. I'm afraid literary criticism has become, you know, very professionalized and impenetrable to ordinary people.
This hour, David Lodge on the war between science and the humanities. Also, what it means to think like a scientist, and what the children of the great conservationist Aldo Leopold learned from their dad.
The most important thing to me was the fact that we really learned to enjoy working. I mean, we'd go out with our shovels and work hard, and we found it pleasurable.
Sarah Flannery isn't your run-of-the-mill teenager. In 1999, the 16-year-old math whiz won Ireland's Young Scientist of the Year award. With a project on the science of cryptography, she went on to win the Young Scientist competition for all of Europe. Irish newspapers declared her a genius, and a London publisher called to see if she'd write a book. Well, she did write that book, called In Code, with the help of her father. And I should add that Sarah's dad, David, is a math professor. Sarah told Anne Strainchamps that learning math from her father taught her more than basic skills.
I think more importantly, it made me see maths as something that was, you know, fun, if you like, and something that I was never alienated against when I was growing up. You know, Dad would and Mum would talk to us about English and maybe read us books and things, but they would also talk to us about maths, which for some people is something that they only meet in school, you know, so it helps just make maths seem a natural thing, as natural as English or Irish or whatever.
Not only do most people not encounter math until they get to school, the idea of talking about it at home would be kind of alien to a lot of people. I mean, what did you talk about?
It was made very simple by the fact that Dad would give us puzzles and everything, so you could have a discussion and sometimes quite a, you know, a lively discussion about a puzzle, and therefore, perhaps in some cases without really realizing it, a lively discussion about maths at the same time.
Some of those puzzles, you give examples of them in the book, and they're great. Can you give a few of them to us?
Oh, well, I mean, there's lots of different ones. There's one having a 3-gallon jar and a 5-gallon jar and an unlimited supply of water, and what you want to do is try and pour out 4 gallons of water. So you've got to figure out how to do that with only your 5-gallon and your 3-gallon jar. That puzzle came up in Die Hard with a Vengeance. Bruce Willis.
How do you solve that one?
Okay, the answer to the puzzle is to fill up the 3-gallon container and to pour it into your 5-gallon one, and then to fill up the 3-gallon container again and again pour it into the 5-gallon container, so that you're left with just 1 gallon in your 3-gallon container. Then you empty the 5-gallon one, pour that 1 gallon from the 3-gallon jug back into the 5-gallon jug, and then fill up the 3-gallon one again and pour it into the 5 gallon so that you have 4 gallons.
That's great. Well, what if, I was wondering if there are any of the other puzzles. I was looking at them to think whether there were any others that we could do on the air without getting out pencil and paper. And I was wondering, maybe the Russian postal system puzzle, that was a good one.
Yeah, this Russian postal system puzzle, as it's called, is definitely one of my favourites. I heard it at the end of a lecture on cryptography in UCC, which is University College Cork, near where I live. And it was given to us by this Russian mathematician who stood up at the end of this lecture and just really wanted to give us this puzzle. So it's simply, the story goes that at one time the Russian postal system was notoriously corrupt. And what I mean by that is that any letter, package or box that was sent through the postal system, which was open or could easily be opened, would be. And the post office clerks would just go through the package or box or whatever and take out anything, whether or not it had any value. And obviously anything which did have value, they'd just pocket, and anything else they'd just throw away. But then, of course, the other end of that is that any letter or box or anything that went through the postal system locked, they wouldn't bother themselves opening it because their pickings were so rich, and they'd just let it go through, even if they did suspect that it contained valuables. And so then the story goes that there's this, you know, this man, Boris, in Moscow, say, and his girlfriend, Natasha, lives all the way across the country in St. Petersburg. And Boris wants to get a jewel, a present that he's bought for Natasha, to her. And the problem is, how do they get it to each other despite the corrupt postal system? And then there's also other information that you can, you know, like I said, if you do have a box and you can buy a padlock and lock it up and send it through the post, knowing that it will get, for example, to Natasha in St. Petersburg safely. But remember that Boris then can't, by letter, send the key, because if the postal clerks, you know, they'll get this letter with a key in it, open it up, the key will have no value to them, but they'll just throw it away.
So he can send her the package locked and she'll get it, but then she doesn't have any way to open it. And if he sends her the key separately, that'll be opened and the key thrown away, so she still won't have the key. So the trick is, how does he both get it to her in such a way that she can open it?
Yeah, I hope I've given everyone all the information. It's hard to think of it. It's a long puzzle to set up. But yeah, that's it.
So how does she manage to get her gift?
Well, this is really one of those puzzles where I absolutely hate giving the answer to it, because it's one of my favourites. It's of a type of puzzle that I don't really like, because it's one where you have to have a flash of inspiration, if you like, or you either see it or you don't in order to get the answer. And so I hate giving the answer immediately, because people lose an appreciation for just how difficult the puzzle could be if the answer doesn't hit you immediately.
Well, because I tried very hard to work it out myself and couldn't, so I can attest that you do have to have that flash of inspiration.
The answer is that what Boris does is he takes this box, a box he has, and he attaches a padlock to it. He puts the gem in first, of course, and unlocks up the box with this padlock and sends it off to Natasha in St. Petersburg. And now, because it's locked, of course, it will arrive there. And when it does arrive there, and this is the solution to the puzzle, really, what Natasha then does is she locks her own lock, to which she has the key, onto the box. And so now sends it back through the postal system again, with both her lock and Boris's lock on it. And so again, it'll arrive safely in Moscow. And when it does so, Boris, because he has the key to his padlock, can then take his padlock off and then send it back to St. Petersburg to Natasha. And when it arrives this time, all it will have is Natasha's lock on it, to which she has the key again, and so she can open it and get her gem.
Oh, and so brilliant!
Yeah, so that really is it's a cute little puzzle. Again, this is an example of something where you're doing a puzzle and the answer is so simple, but it may never have got, you know, it may never have struck you really. But also what you're doing at the same time is demonstrating how you can achieve secure communication over an insecure channel, which is something that, you know, a little child could do if the answer came to them.
Now, you've gone on to develop that interest in puzzles into your work on cryptography. And when you won Ireland's Young Scientist of the Year award, it was actually for an algorithm having to do with cryptography. What was it like going to the Young Scientist competition?
The year I won the Young Scientist, going up there was, I had been there the year before, so I felt nervous in a different way as to when I did back then. I kind of knew how things would happen, but it was still so exciting and I felt I could appreciate it even more. I knew what was going to happen. I was going to be judged so many times and, you know, I really wanted to go out there and kind of show those judges what I knew and show them, you know, what my project was all about, and like that I had really enjoyed doing it and still really enjoyed it. And I really did enjoy the whole experience of being at the Young Scientist competition. I think it's, if anyone has an opportunity to, you know, take part in that and to get the experience of being judged and even to have to present your project and display your project, they're all such important lessons.
Yeah, it sounded, just from the way you described it, there's this image I have in my mind of you and these two mathematicians just poring over your explanations, and you're scribbling things on a pad to show them how you've worked things out. And for the three of you, it's like there's nobody else in the room, this huge crowded room and people, but you're just in your own world, completely absorbed.
I just cannot explain how excited I was, how nervous at the same time. I just loved that. I know that had I not won the competition after that point, in one sense, it wouldn't really have mattered to me, because I had done that. I had had such a good time describing my project to those two judges. It was fantastic. It was, you know, it's what science is all about, being able to talk to fellow scientists. And, you know, it was brilliant. It makes me excited to think about it again. Definitely.
Sarah Flannery is now a student at Cambridge University. She and her father David wrote the book In Code, A Mathematical Journey. Anne Strangeham spoke with her. What's it like to grow up with a great scientist? Well, it made quite an impression on the children of conservationist Aldo Leopold. All five became scientists themselves. Three were inducted into the National Academy of Sciences. And remarkably, Leopold never pushed his kids into these careers. In fact, when the family spent weekends at their land in central Wisconsin, the children had no idea they were part of a grand experiment in prairie restoration. Today, Aldo Leopold's A Sand County Almanac is a nature writing classic, and the shack, the little chicken coop where the Leopolds stayed during those weekends, has become a kind of sacred shrine to the environmental movement. Steve Paulson recently sat down with three of Aldo's children, Carl and Estella Leopold and Nina Leopold Bradley, and asked them about the first time they saw the shack. Carl.
We came in a cold February day, and Dad had said he had bought a farm, and it was on by the Wisconsin River, and it was going to be lots of fun. And I thought, at least, of having a cottage next to the river and with a screen porch where you could play poker or play bridge or do things of the sort.
And
there was a big letdown.
It was no cottage, but it was by the river.
Well, sort of.
And we walked into this chicken coop, and it was about this high in manure, frozen, of course, it being February. And Mother said something like, "Aldo, are you sure you want to bring the children up here?"
So there were literally several feet of manure in the chicken
and
coop?
And we had a pickaxe and shovels, and we spent the first day getting rid of the manure, wheelbarrowing it out of the old barn. That was the shack.
And it was kind of interesting. Of course, one of the first jobs was to try to make this chicken coop a little bit more habitable. And my father, instead of going to the lumber yard to pick up whatever we could use on this project, we would go to the river. And all of us would walk
Or the dump.
Up, or the dump.
Yeah, the dump was a favorite place for
And we would
materials.
Walk upriver and pick up any kind of 2x4 or whatever would be usable. And it wasn't until Sand County Almanac came out that we really understood the kinds of things that my father was thinking about. He made it into almost
This business
poetry.
Of scrap lumber was sometimes taken rather to the extreme. For instance, the joists, overhead joists that held up the roof over the bunkhouse were too short, so that they were butted end to end and then was patched with little pieces of 2x4 holding them together.
Well, I have to say, this is not exactly the way to get your children hooked on being out in the land, I would think. To see this heap of a chicken coop, and I guess the land itself was kind of run down too, wasn't it?
It was dismal.
Yes.
It was
definitely.
Cockle burrs and quack grass.
And sand burrs. And there was a great barren landscape with rundown fences, but you could see all over the place. But these were worn out soils, and obviously the guy had gone broke in the 30s.
And then
I
the
suppose.
House burned down when the bootlegger that had been inhabiting it had caught fire. And
the previous owner was a bootlegger?
The last owner, I think, was a bootlegger.
But can't you imagine five teenage kids? This was a wonderful challenge. The one I think that was the real queen that made it happen correctly was our mother. She was not disparaging. She dug right in just with all the rest of us. She met the challenge.
And so we would go camping up there almost every weekend of life, and it went on and on for years, right? And it was Mother who'd pack the picnic baskets and get everybody rounded up, and we'd all get in the car and drive off in the cloud of dust or whatever.
Now, did your father pick this land because it was so run down? Was that part of the point?
So run down and so remote. And he wrote even an essay about being run down and hard to reach and can be sometimes isolated. And that was very important part of it, that it wasn't next to a real road and people couldn't come to visit unless they were invited on a good weather day.
In fact, he wrote, "My own farm was selected for its lack of goodness and its lack of highway. In fact, my whole neighborhood lies in the backwash of the River Progress."
And good so what Carl is referring to in Nina, too, is the great floods that would come in the spring and the fall, and it made it quite difficult, Professor Leopold, to get back to class on Monday. It also made it hard to get in, which we used to do with waiters, or just wading in a mile and a half walk to the little shack.
Now, today, this is often called one of America's first acts of ecological restoration, what you all and your father, Aldo Leopold,
did. That was a really interesting point, because we were not really aware of it. That we didn't set out in that manner, but we were actually participating with Dad on a major experiment. And so, yes, you're right. It was a very novel and new idea about restoring.
And we can add to that, Carl, that Dad made a big point of only bringing in native species of, for example, the pines that we planted. And the herbs and the perennials, the wildflowers, were all to be native species. And we hoped that soon, by burning the prairie and so forth, that we would get rid of the weeds. And, of course, that happened.
I thought Dad showed an amazing skill in the way he trained us, which really wasn't training us at all. He never sat down and explained to us that we are trying to restore this property into what it looked like before white man took it away from the Indians. And so year after year, as we planted and things survived or didn't survive, we finally got the idea. And it was not by his telling us exactly what to do.
So you didn't ask him, gee, Dad, why are we doing all of this? That never occurred to any of you to ask?
It didn't occur to me.
We sure went along with the fun of doing it, and it was beautiful.
That's right.
It was really beautiful.
The fun was really the driving force.
But an example of this, I think, is Dad kept very careful records of all the natural events of the season. And so we all participated in keeping track of these records. And I remember walking into camp one day and I had said, Dad, the martens are here. And Dad looked at me with this wonderful smile. I'm sure the martens had come 2 weeks earlier. But that was the way we were learning.
Hmm. Now, I've heard that he didn't always give an easy answer to a question. I mean, I'm curious about the whole educational process. I mean, here you grew up with one of the great conservationists of the 20th century, but the education was very subtle, is what you're saying.
It was indeed. For me, it was.
True.
Yeah.
Well, I'll give you an example. When this was, Dad was quite elderly at the time, but anyhow, he wrote in his book that the survival of oaks in our place probably came in low rabbit years because the rabbits chewed off the oaks and they tasted good in winter. So he proposed that there was a rabbit cycle and then an oak cycle would be counter to that. So I did, told Dad I was going to do a thesis on that topic. And he said, that's okay. It might work out. You know. And I did, and it did, and so forth. And it was a good idea, obviously, his idea. But he didn't tell you what to do, of course.
But he planted he wanted you to do it.
I think it turned out well, yes.
Now, you mentioned the significance your father gave to record keeping. He was a meticulous record keeper?
Oh, yes, definitely.
And he wrote, keeping records enhances the pleasure of the search and the chance of finding order and meaning in these events. 'Tis true. We're still keeping records on the same property.
And I suppose that's really part of the art of being a naturalist, the naming of things and knowing when things happen. I mean, that's half of the scientific enterprise.
One of the biologists at the University of Wisconsin, when I was around here, was Jim Zimmerman. And he said, you know, what's really unique about Leopold's shack is that he goes to one place over and over again and records and sees the events of the seasons. And he said, what a pleasure. What a natural historical source of information.
And it's also uncertain when Dad bought the property and started this whole thing. Was he really intending to carry out this big super experiment? That was it really a part of his professional direction, or was it really just for fun? And I honestly don't know.
I guess the most important thing to me was the fact that we really learned to enjoy working. I mean, we'd go out with our shovels and work hard, and we found it pleasurable. I think for teenage kids, that was quite an accomplishment on Dad's part.
I agree. I think that was amazing.
And I think you can add that we learned to take good care of tools. Dad was very careful to keep the tools shiny and sharp, and that they should never be put away when they were wet or muddy.
So why did this take? I mean, why didn't you resent being asked to do all of this labor?
Look, that's an impossible question to answer. It's the same as the question about how come all the siblings went into science. I haven't a clue. I honestly don't know.
I think it was because Dad and Mother didn't push it on us. Dad would not even invite us to go to the shack. He'd say, your mother and I are going to the shack. Anybody want to come? And, of course, we all wanted to come, and we'd bring our friends. But I think had they urged it on us, we might have had a different response. It's only a guess, Steve.
Well, I have to follow up on the other point you made, Carl, the fact that the three of you and your two siblings all went into science and pursued careers in one way or another with a deep love of the natural world.
Right.
I would have thought there would have been some rebellion here. I mean, at least one of you would have
Wouldn't
gone
you?
Off and
Wouldn't
say,
you
know, yes, I'm not going to do this.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So why not?
I have no, I just don't understand. I can't believe it. It's just amazing. And it's extremely rare. I think that there are occasional families where this happens, but it's pretty unusual.
I think Dad was awesome. He really was. And it was all very subtle. But
he was a little secretive, in fact. Mm-hmm. He wasn't out in front with telling you what's going to happen and what you're going to, you do this, you do that, as Nina has already said.
Now, your father died on this land as he was, died from a heart attack as he was fighting a grass fire. And Estella, you were there that day?
Yes, and it was, of course, we're all in horrendous shock when we realized what had happened. But Mother had been posted by Dad to keep the fire from crossing the road at some point, a little upstream from where the brush fire was. I was sent to get help from a fire truck, and they wouldn't come, but then was out in the marsh, as Dad had instructed, making sure that it didn't travel northward toward our farm. And we got the news from a farmer walking toward me in the marsh that something had happened to Dad. And somehow, I just knew what it was. It's terrible, but one knows.
Did he have any history of heart trouble?
Not that I'm aware
of. I don't think so.
He had just had a complete checkup, and everything was fine.
Yeah. So I think it was a terribly frightening time. That fire was frightening.
A marvelous sort of symbolism of an ecologist who's dedicated to trying to do, shall we say, restoration and improvement of the quality of a community. For him to be killed doing a very dramatic component of tending to the land this is pretty extraordinary.
Today, Carl and Estella Leopold and Nina Leopold Bradley are board members of the Aldo Leopold Foundation, based in Baraboo, Wisconsin. They talked with Steve Paulson. A Sand County Almanac was published in 1949, shortly after Leopold died. Since then, it's inspired generations of nature lovers, and even some musicians.
Out of the clouds, I hear a faint bark, as of a faraway dog. It is strange how the world cocks its ears at that sound, wondering. Soon it is louder, the honk of geese, invisible but coming on. The flock emerges from the low clouds, a tattered banner of birds, dipping and rising, blown up, blown down, blown together and blown apart. But at advancing, the wind wrestling lovingly with each winnowing wing. When the flock is a blur in the far sky, I hear the last honk. Sounding taps for the summer.
An excerpt from a Sand County Almanac, read by Carl Schmidt. The music of Douglas Hill, performed by the Oakwood Chamber Players. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Stem cell research is pushing the edge of science, but what makes me feel queasy are the scientists trying to create the first human clone, despite warnings that such efforts may lead to deformed babies. Well, To the Best of Our Knowledge has discovered that a certain scientist, by the name of Dr. Viktor Raskolnikov, has already cloned several human beings.
Isn't it great? Aren't we a pair? I am no longer alone with you over there. Send in the clone.
Okay, come on in, clone. Single file, please.
With two of us working.
Working.
We're multiplying faster.
Faster.
We've cloned ourselves so many times.
Over.
We've lost track of who's the master. But we'd be surprised. If it's the one with five eyes.
Hey there, five eyes.
We have cloned sheep. And a pig's tush. But one thing is sure. We won't clone George Bush.
Either one of them. No way.
Because that would be wrong. Yes, it would bring
shame.
We may be mad. But we're not insane.
We're sane.
Millions of us. Without any wounds.
No wounds whatsoever.
Making a fortune with our new Franken legumes.
Gumes.
There's only one problem.
Problem?
It's such a long wait to use the bathroom.
Hey, are you almost finished in there? I really gotta go. Hurry up.
Dr. Viktor Raskolnikov and the Clonettes were discovered by our special correspondent, Doug Gorton. How do you know if some hot new scientific discovery is legit? Well, you can't always trust scientists.
It's one of my rules that there is no claim so preposterous that a PhD scientist cannot be found to vouch for it.
Physicist Robert Park believes we're inundated by pseudoscience and outright fraud. He's even written a book called Voodoo Science. He says bad science first caught his eye back in 1983, when he watched a CBS News report about a Mississippi mechanic named Joe Newman, who claimed he'd invented something that looked suspiciously like a perpetual motion machine.
Newman was suing the patent office. Now, the patent office, clear back in 1911, had passed a new rule. They were so annoyed, the patent commissioner was, by all of the applications for these impossible machines, that he laid down a new rule, and that was that if you wanted to apply for a patent for a perpetual motion machine, you had to file a working model with the patent office. And a year later, if it was still running, you could submit your application. And that pretty well had ended the claims of perpetual motion machines. But Joe Newman added a new wrinkle. He claimed it wasn't really a perpetual motion machine. He said it was based on the theory of Albert Einstein, and what it was doing was converting the copper coils and the iron cores of the magnets into energy according to E equals mc squared, and that eventually the machine would in fact be devoured, but c squared is such a big number that for all practical purposes it would run forever.
Tell me about the machine.
Well, it was essentially a motor generator. But Joe Newman had taken, I guess, a self-help course in electricity and magnetism, and he had discovered the remarkable fact that if you take a turn of wire, pass a current through it, you get a magnetic field. If you take two loops, you get twice the magnetic field with the same current. Now, he said, that's powerful stuff, and if I just add enough loops, I should be able to create a perpetual motion machine. I would get such a powerful magnet. Well, it doesn't work quite that way, of course, because you've, in order to actually make an engine out of this, a motor, you've got to be able to turn the power on and off. And the more loops you have, the more work you have to do that. So it, of course, could not work. And the nice thing about the first law of thermodynamics is you don't have to know what's in the box.
I'm curious whether you found this to be a consistent truth through the stories that you've examined, that people want to believe.
Well, they do want to believe, and of course they want to believe some things much more than others. But in fact, I speculate that wanting to believe may be sort of a genetic inheritance from our primitive ancestors. Long before there was science, they had little means of understanding the forces in the world around them. And I think there was perhaps a sort of protective advantage to belief in certain things. You had to be motivated enough to take action. So you, in order to take action, you've got to believe in something. And I think we may just have inherited, if you will, a belief gene. I don't mean that quite literally. But
yeah. Let's take another example. There was, for instance, the Project to Reduce Violent Crime. Can you tell us about that?
Well, in fact, the person who was in charge of that program was a Ph.D. physicist, once again. His name is John Hagelin. He has a Ph.D. from Harvard University and has done significant theoretical work in physics. But at some point, he became a follower of the Maharishi. In one year, when Washington was justly famous for their crime levels, they decided that they would come to Washington and have a program to reduce the crime by meditating. And they brought in 4,000 trained meditators to meditate in unison. Now, when you meditate in unison, apparently it's supposed to create a much more powerful effect. And they were going to reduce crime and spread tranquility throughout the city. Uh-huh. Now, they did this in the summer, and it seemed like an old mad scientist story gone awry. I mean, the murder level in Washington rose to a height that it had never reached before or since, for that matter.
And it doesn't seem to confirm their theory, does it?
Well, as a matter of fact, at the end of the summer, they called a press conference and declared success. They said they had reduced violent crime by 18%. And when they were asked, well, you know, 18% compared to what? And they said, well, compared to what it would have been if we had not been meditating. So
it's kind of setting your own standards for scientific data, isn't it?
That's right. And ideas out of the mainstream, there's a belief out there that the scientific establishment is going to fight any sort of change that anyone proposes, any fundamental change. And, of course, what they really do is challenge the person making the claim to produce better evidence. The demand for better evidence is always there. A good example was when the claim was made by Luis Alvarez that perhaps the dinosaurs had been, their extinction had been produced by the impact of an asteroid with the Earth. Most geologists were terribly upset by this. They were used to the idea of gradual geologic processes. They had, in fact, always fought against the religious creationists with their catastrophism theories. So they sort of automatically rejected this idea. But what it did was simply force those that thought this might be right to produce better and better evidence. And eventually they found the evidence worldwide. They found the remains of the crater where it hit. They can see the fragments washed up on the shores of the Gulf of Mexico. It was a grand example, I think, yeah, of how a new revolutionary and at first highly criticized theory later became accepted by essentially everyone.
Skepticism forced better science in that case.
Skepticism forced better science.
There is another case in your book where that did not occur, and that's the case of the public power lines and the link to cancer. The stories that Paul Brodeur wrote about in The New Yorker that I remember reading and found very persuasive. Obviously, yeah, a lot of other people did as well, but you've called that voodoo science as well?
Well, it was, in fact, a splendid example of voodoo science. When he wrote those articles, many scientists stepped forward immediately and said, look, I can do a simple calculation for you that shows this just can't be. The laws of electromagnetism are pretty well known, and you can sit down and do some pretty straightforward calculations that says that, look, the fields from power lines just cannot be having any significant effect whatever on the human body.
They're not strong enough?
Well, it's the energy involved. The electromagnetic radiation, which includes X-rays and gamma rays, these things can certainly induce cancer. But those are very energetic waves. If you go down in frequency, they become less and less energetic. So the kind of the least energetic electromagnetic radiation that can break a chemical bond would be in the near ultraviolet, which is what we worry about when we put our sunblock on. But for something below the ultraviolet, below the visible, below the infrared, below the radio waves, way down to 60 cycles, it cannot break a chemical bond. And all the cancer-inducing mechanisms that we know, chemical carcinogens, atomic radiation, all of these things, all cause, the initial cause of the cancer, is mutations as a result of breaking chemical bonds. So if you don't have energy to break a chemical bond, it just isn't going to happen.
Now with the power line business, weren't there studies that showed that there were areas where there were children especially suffering from leukemia who were in close proximity to power transformers?
That's right. There were studies that indicated that. The statistics were rather poor. And furthermore, they didn't really measure the fields they were exposed to. They estimated them on the basis of the size and proximity of the power lines. Well, there are a lot of possible confounding factors there. For one thing, poor people live closer to their power lines, and poor people have more cancers. I mean, it's not a fair world. For a variety of reasons, perhaps different health care, perhaps because their parents work in chemical environments that office workers don't work in. For a variety of reasons that are not clear, poverty is a factor in cancer. So there's a confounding factor right off. Poor people live close to their power lines. They live in congested areas. As the studies got better, as they did larger and larger studies and made better and better measurements, the effect got smaller and smaller. And that's usually the first indication. You do better studies and the effect gets smaller. And ultimately, the largest study done in the United States on childhood leukemia was done by the National Cancer Institute, and the results were released just a couple of years ago. And what they found was that there was absolutely no link at all between exposure to power line fields and leukemia in children. Since that time, almost identical study has been done in Canada, again, a very large study with very good statistics. It also found no effect. It was then repeated in Great Britain. Once again, they found no effect. And incidentally, as one measure of that, there are no court cases now. Nobody is suing power companies for power line fields any longer. It simply could not stand up in court with the kind of evidence that we have now.
Robert Park is a physicist at the University of Maryland. He's the author of Voodoo Science. Suppose you wanted to conduct a small experiment to record your random thoughts at precisely the moment they popped into your head. How'd you do it? In David Lodge's novel Thinks, one of his characters dictates into a tape recorder.
1, 2, 3, testing, testing. Recorder working okay. Olympus Pearl Corder. Bought it at Heathrow in the duty free on my way to... where? Can't remember. Doesn't matter. The object of the exercise being to record as accurately as possible the thoughts that are passing through my head at this moment in time, which is, let's see, 10:13 a.m. on Sunday the 23rd of February... San Diego. I bought it on my way to that conference in... Isabel Hotchkiss. Of course, San Diego.
Up next, comic novelist David Lodge investigates the slippery science of consciousness. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Some people eagerly await the latest novel by Philip Roth, John Updike, or Barbara Kingsolver. For Steve Paulson, any new offering by David Lodge is an event worth savoring. Lodge's latest novel, Thinks, is set on a fictional university campus where a scientist named Ralph Messenger studies the nature of consciousness. Ralph is a chronic womanizer, and he soon sets his sights on a visiting novelist, Helen Reed.
Basically, the novel is about their intellectual and personal relationship. I mean, Ralph pursues her. She is intrigued by him. She is challenged by his view of the world and tries to combat it. And it's a sort of game of cat and mouse between them, I suppose one might say.
And Ralph is basically a materialist. He doesn't believe in the soul or in religion. And for him, consciousness is basically just a bunch of neurons firing away. And when someone dies, that just means the virtual machine has shut down.
Exactly, yes. And Helen, who had a Catholic upbringing, she's not a practicing Catholic, but she sort of still clings wistfully to some faint hope that possibly there is some survival after death. And this is a matter of considerable importance to her because her husband's just died. And so part of the relationship between them is an argument about that, about personal identity and whether it survives death. She's in a weak position because she isn't a real believer. But on the other hand, she feels that...
She feels there's got to be something more than what Ralph is
saying. There's
got to
be something. If Ralph's worldview is true, then she finds that impossibly bleak, almost intolerable. So that's the kind of argument between them.
Now, I've heard you described as an agnostic Catholic writer, which is exactly what...
Yeah, I describe myself as that, yes.
Which is what Helen Reed is, this novelist in your story. Yeah. Are you naturally sympathetic with her perspective?
I mean, it's very much my own, I would say, except I still actually am a kind of practicing Catholic, but intellectually I'm not very different from her. I think that when I say I'm an agnostic Catholic, I suppose I mean that I don't think we will know or can know what the language of religion actually refers to. We can use it as a kind of metaphorical language for dealing with, you know, problems about why are we here and what is it all about.
Now, you obviously did a lot of research for this novel. I mean, I'm sure you don't have to research how novelists think, but in terms of what scientists do as they study consciousness, you must have dug through what the leading thinkers are saying.
Absolutely, yes. Well, I found it all very fascinating, and it was partly that I had taken consciousness for granted in a way, as perhaps most writers do, is what we deal with. So one thing that was, you know, all very interesting and completely new to me was the, what you might call the neurobiological stuff. which has made enormous leaps in recent times with new scanning techniques so that neuroscientists can actually locate where particular kinds of consciousness, emotional or intellectual, take place in the brain.
You have a wonderful exchange at one point in the novel when Ralph is saying that the problem of consciousness is to give an objective third-person account of what is essentially a subjective first-person phenomenon, and then Helen responds by saying, well, that's, of course, exactly what novelists have been doing for the last 200 years.
Yes, and it is. And Ralph says, well, that's just trickery. It's just an illusion. It's just a lie, really, that novelists give the impression that they can know what goes on in other people's heads, but it's just a kind of trick. But, you know, Helen says, well, that's why we read novels, actually. It's because we can sort of, through the artifice of the novel, get some notion of what it is to be other than ourselves. That would perhaps one of the reasons why we need fiction, which doesn't have any other sort of obvious utilitarian purpose, and yet people do seem to desperately want and need stories all the time. And the novel is a form of storytelling which is embedded in consciousness. I mean, the philosophical interest in consciousness begins in the 18th century at exactly the time that the novel becomes the dominant literary form. So that's not coincidental, I think.
But I suppose from the scientist's perspective, I mean, their response to a novelist like Helen is, well, sure, you can write about what someone else might be thinking, but that's just all how you imagine it. You don't really know if anyone else thinks that way. You can never get inside another person's head.
Absolutely, yes. I suppose it's a commonplace observation, but it's not something that we think about. Perhaps we don't care to think about it very much. If you imagine what other people may be thinking about you in the same way that you think about them, you realize that public communication that goes on between people is just a very thin layer over a kind of huge seething mass of often, you know, hostile or doubtful, you know, amoral or whatever thoughts and feelings, which really civilization requires us to suppress.
Well, and the joke in your story is really that, well, Ralph is doing a running commentary on tape, trying to record his stream of consciousness as it pops into his head. Helen writes a journal, and what they're really mainly thinking about are their adulterous fantasies. It's not terribly high-minded.
No, I mean, Ralph actually swiftly realizes that his experiment is doomed to failure, because the very act of articulating a thought, however, you know, roughly or randomly, is already some distance from the actual phenomenon of consciousness, which is probably, you know, pre-verbal at some point. But he gets kind of interested in the merely confessional aspect of the exercise, so it stops being an experiment, it becomes a habit.
Now, what you're doing in this novel is essentially revisiting the old debate between science and the humanities, and I guess I'm wondering if you see whether this debate has changed at all since C.P. Snow wrote about the two cultures many decades ago.
I think it's changed, first of all, in that people in the arts and the humanities are rather more open to the scientific view of the world than they were when Snow published his famous Two Cultures lecture and elicited a furious response from F.R. Leavis as the sort of representative of the humanities. And I think in those days there was a complete face-off between, you know, the sciences and the arts, the mutual hostility.
And Snow's argument was that they were really two entirely different cultures and they couldn't really talk to each other.
Right. And his point was scientists were prepared to make the effort, but people on the humanities side were not, which I think is probably a fair description. I mean, what's happened in recently, it's very striking. A number of literary novelists have started to write about subjects with a scientific dimension to them at more or less the same time. I'm one of them, but it hasn't been a case of copying. It's the zeitgeist. I think we all started to get interested at the same time. I mean, there are two areas which have excited literary imaginations. One is cosmology, the whole thing about the origin of the universe and its possible death and the extraordinary discoveries of modern astronomy and all that. That's excited some people. And the other is consciousness, precisely, which used not to be a subject of much interest to science, but has become so. And because consciousness is, in a way, the very essence of human nature, and also because the study of it is mainly either neurobiological or computer-based. It's not mathematical, which is what puts most people off hard science, because they haven't got the math to do it, you know. This is certainly true of me. But because consciousness studies is not really much about math and is a lot about psychology, biology, and because it has all kinds of philosophical conundrums associated with it, I think it's something that literary people, artists, can get a purchase on and feel they have something to contribute and participate. So I think there's now more possibility of a real dialogue between the arts and the sciences than there was when Snow first formulated this view of the two cultures.
And it seems that the other thing that has happened, particularly in the last decade, is a number of very good writers have been writing about science, popularizing science.
Absolutely.
And to some degree, these are some of the most significant books that have been published. And I suppose you could even argue that to some degree, science writing, good science writing, has usurped some of the status of literature.
Well, you take the words out of my mouth, actually. Yes, I mean, I completely agree with you. Popular science writing has had an extraordinary flowering in the last 10 or 20 years. And I agree that it has come very much to replace the position in culture which literary criticism used to have. I'm afraid literary criticism has become, you know, very professionalized and impenetrable to ordinary people. And the scientists have moved in to occupy the vacuum, I think. Many of them, Richard Dawkins is an obvious example, but there are many others, write extremely well with real style, and the works are often quite enthralling. It was very useful to me when I got interested in this subject that there were lots of books of that caliber to read. And I mean, it seemed to me when I was researching the book that there was a new work on consciousness coming out almost every week, you know, with an incredible number of books.
David Lodge, talking with Steve Paulson. Lodge's novel is called Thinks. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced by Steve Paulson, Mary Lou Finnegan, Veronica Rickert, Doug Gordon, and Anne Strainchamps, with technical help from Marv Nunn and Kirill Wheeler. You can buy a tape of this hour by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for Thinking Like a Scientist, program number 819B.
PRI, Public Radio International.